Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Papua New Guinea police have launched the most intensive effort yet to move refugees occupying the decommissioned Manus Island Detention Center. Police, soldiers, and Papua New Guinea government officials went into the center at about 7 o'clock local time this past week to move the refugees to three new facilities on the island. Johnny Blades spoke to Sudanese refugee at the center, Abdul Aziz Adam, who says the raid is at a level of aggression not experienced since the deadly riot at the center in 2014.
The police came up in early morning around 10 to 7. Police, immigration, including the defense force, they have got their loudspeakers and they were telling people to move out from the detention center to the new facility. But unfortunately, none of those men actually wanted to move out. So they move up, they came to Delta compound, and then they start pushing people, swearing and beating. So far, two refugees has been arrested, and one of them, he has been beaten up in front of the other peoples. And also they want to arrest too many people, but the refugees are all together. They shined their hands together. They were sitting on the floor and shouting that we are a peaceful and we don't want your country and we don't want to move. So please stop forcing us. And the police are so aggressive and they are throwing stones. They're carrying a baton. Some of them, they are carrying sticks and they're swearing and shouting. So it's really crazy moment that we are in right now.
This isn't something they've done before like this. This is a new level of intensity from the police.
This is a totally something that it hasn't been done before. And this is what is happening right now. It's similar to 2014 riot when we have lost our brother Reza Barati. So it is getting worse and worse every minute. The police are still inside the compound, but the refugees are not talking, are not saying anything. The police are swearing at the refugee. Some of them, they spit on them, and then they say, this is our country, and you are guys illegal in our country. You have to move out of this place. So the tension is really, really high, and this is similar to the 2014 incident. And we are praying that no one will get hurt. From our side, we are peaceful, but the police and the immigrations are provoking us.
Advocates who secretly entered the former detention center on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island say the health of refugees there is in peril. A physician, Dr. Patrick McGorry, who has seen the advocates' footage, says preventable diseases seem imminent. About 400 men detained without charge by Australia since 2013 are refusing to move to other facilities on the island, despite power, water, food, and medication being cut when the center was closed at the end of October. Natasha Blucher from Melbourne's Asylum Psycho Resource Centre entered the centre last week with three colleagues. She told Ben Robinson Drawbridge, the situation is a medical emergency.
I think what was the most shocking was the deterioration of the men's health and mental health. These are people who have been locked up for 4 years now, and many people just by being in the RPC have developed serious mental health issues and kind of serious ongoing chronic health conditions like kidney stones, urinary tract infections, rashes, lesions, skin abscesses. And a lot of that has been medicated over a long period and kind of maintenance managed, I think would be the best way to describe it, by the medical provider who was in the camp previously. But now there's absolutely no medical attention at all, and these health conditions and mental health conditions are just escalating very, very dangerously.
Exacerbated by the loss of water?
Yeah, so very limited access to water. The water that is being accessed doesn't appear to be clean. When we looked at it, there was a bit of a greasy film on the top, and it's appeared to be quite dirty. They're doing some water collection with sheets, so attaching bottles to sheets, and when it rains, the sheets saturate and then it drops down into the smaller water bottles that are tied to the bottoms of the sheets. That rainwater is probably clean to a degree, but there's not a lot of it. And because people have quite serious health conditions and it's very hot and humid, people need to drink a lot of water, and that's just not happening at this time.
But are there risks to their health by drinking this water?
It looks that way to me. I'm not a health professional, but I did spend most of my time inside the camp being taken to the sickest men who were there. And everybody was saying that they were accessing very little water and that the water that they were accessing was unclean. We saw the facilities. The facilities were quite horrific because the men don't have any means of cleaning them. There's no water to clean them with. And when you're looking at 400 men in a camp with no running water, trying to use very limited facilities that were limited in the first place, even when the camp was running, the hygiene conditions are appalling.
Now, about the time the centre was closed, I know that men were allocated about 4 weeks' worth of medicine. Do they still have some of that medicine?
When we were there last Wednesday, almost everybody that I saw said they either had 1 or 2 days of medication left, or they had none at all. I think one of the difficulties is when people have complex health conditions and they're elderly or they have mental health issues, it's difficult for them to manage their own medication. So it's possible that people were kind of taking their medication in the wrong order or too frequently or not frequently enough. But certainly everybody that I spoke to was either out of medication or was very close to being out of medication. And some of that medication is imperative for life with serious physical health conditions, but also I think, you know, any person knows who has had anything to do with anyone who's needed medication, antidepressants for their mental health, and in some cases in the camp, more serious mental health conditions, it's very dangerous to come off that medication quickly, and that's exactly what's happening now. And apart from the physical health conditions, that's what scares me the most, is people coming very quickly off antidepressants and trying to survive in a really difficult situation. And I think that's quite simply very dangerous, even in a situation where you have access to medical care. So we saw a lot of people caring for sick men. We talked a lot to people who were supporting others. They were all very much banding together, sharing what little food they had. We were told stories of the way that people kind of pretend they're not hungry so that their friends can eat, and how people were going without what little water they could access so that the sicker men could drink that water. But I was also struck by the fact that there really is a sheer kind of terror of moving into Loringal. And I think that's kind of twofold. It's because there have been a lot of attacks in the past on refugees that have gone into the town, but also because these are people that have been locked up, as I say, for over 4 years now, and they feel like they simply can't go to another prison. It's almost like they've come to the end of their ability to cope with captivity, and they need to be free, and they need to have an end in sight to their incarceration. And at the moment, being asked to move to another place of detention with no kind of future mapped out, no time limit, no safe pathway to, you know, a safe country to live in, which is all that these men want, I think they can't find it within themselves to move themselves to a place where they'll just be detained indefinitely yet again.
The head of the Commonwealth Observer Group says having two successful women candidates in last week's Tongan election may be the start of greater representation in the country's parliament. Since 1951, there have only been 8 women in Tonga's parliament, including 5 elected. But now, Rosalie Maisa has joined the re-elected Asakata Lavalatuva in the House, Jenny Mayer reports.
Former New Zealand Cabinet Minister Margaret Wilson led the Commonwealth team that observed the elections for the first time, and she says the election of the two women is significant.
I think it does show progress, and the level of campaigning was much more professional and sophisticated, and I think in the next election you will certainly see further campaigns from women candidates, and hopefully they will produce more women being elected.
The head of Tonga's Civil Society Forum says groups from around Tonga are gathering to celebrate the achievement. Sialo Ilohahia says 15 women stood in the election, and all the candidates are getting together with the two MPs and their supporters to reflect on what's happened. She says the group aims to inspire girls into future politics.
So we need to work with the young women to start getting them to this platform, start articulating how they could value their voting, at the same time inspire them by listening to how these women reflected, you know, the successes, the challenges, and how their learnings from this experience.
But Tonga's Women and Children's Crisis Centre says while they are very happy the two women have been elected, they are disappointed only 14% of the vote went to women. Team leader Lasia Lokatui Toya says it may be time for reserved seats or quotas to get more women into parliament. Ms. Toya says the centre has analysed the election results and the national vote for women was low, with just over 5,500 votes for female candidates from a total count of just under 40,000.
That's only 14% of all the votes. And then the 86%, all those votes went to male candidates. So we are looking forward. In the near future, there will be legislation for party system to assist female candidates.
Siali Ilohahia says even though women won just 14% of the vote, it is an improvement from the previous election where 6% of the vote went to women. She says the result represents progress.
But if we really look at the context in terms of Tonga, how culturally representing our society to parliament has always been viewed as something that is actually only for men. And we are coming from a very hierarchy society, and that cultural perceptions is very much institutional in how the voters think, yeah? And that has been coming with us for so long.
Ms. Ilohahia acknowledges the fact that both elected women were part of the powerful Democratic Party, who won 14 out of 17 seats, also appears to be a factor in their success. The Crisis Centre's director, Ofa Gutenbeil-Lekileke, says many of the women candidates placed second in their electorates, but she says last-minute spending of constituency development funds favoured the incumbents, as many voters believed they were spending their own money rather than realising it was allocated funding.
14 of the 15 women, apart from Akosita, did not have their advantage. So they had to go in competing against current members of parliament who had their constituency development fund at their disposal.
Ms. Gutenbeil-Lekileke says while special measures and quotas are short-term solutions for greater representation, the long-term solution is education, as many children are still faced with gender stereotypes in the home. This is Jenny Meyer.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Pacific Island nations could lose between 50 and 80% of their fish species by the end of the century if climate change continues unabated. The figure is published in a new study published by the journal Marine Policy, which examined more than 1,000 species across the region to see how they are reacting to changes in the ocean. Its lead researcher, Associate Professor Rebecca Ashoff from the University of Carolina, says the Pacific's temperatures has little variability, with the temperature being more or less the same all year. She told Jamie Tahana this means species are unlikely to be able to adapt to dramatic changes in ocean temperatures and could die out.
So we did look at two climate change scenarios, one that's a warmer kind of scenario where we're getting changes generally between 2 and 4 degrees. There is a scenario where basically if everyone came together and really took mitigating climate change seriously, the warming would only be about 1 degree, which would be a much better situation.
And on that sort of more bleak scenario, a prediction of between 50 and 80% of species extinction or migration, that's a very dramatic number. How did you come to that?
Well, what we did is we looked at the habitat species used and where the habitat will be in the future. And then on a regional basis, what we looked at is for each region of the ocean, how much species are gained locally versus how many basically leave that area. So it's a local extinction. Those species still might be occurring in other parts of the ocean, but not necessarily the regions where they were in the past. So what we've been kind of finding is that the gains for most areas are fairly low. They're often between about 2 to 6% of biodiversity, where these losses are a lot higher. And there are some areas where it does exceed 80%, but over a lot of the Pacific, you have losses that are kind of in the 50 to 60% range. And this is under kind of the end of the century, under kind of the higher climate change impact scenario.
Is that largely because the Pacific's quite a static temperature and the species can't adapt to a change?
That's part part of it. So basically, if you look at kind of the seasonal cycle of how much temperature varies, the most variability over the course of the year tends to be in the mid-latitudes. And in the low latitudes, as well as at the poles, you don't get as much change, which means that organisms are often very kept adapted to a narrow range of temperature. And that means that, you know, if temperatures go beyond that range, you're either going to have species migrating out of area, decreasing in abundance, or in some cases, you could get adaptation to these changes. But the question is just the changes are happening fairly quickly, so can organisms adapt quickly enough?
Yeah, because adaptation's a sort of really slow process, isn't it? And if, you know, we've had these dramatic changes in mere decades, there's this...
No, that's exactly it. Like, there are some cases where you can get rapid evolution, but that's something that I think we can't count on happening.
To what extent is this affecting the species that, you know, Pacific Islanders rely on for their livelihoods or sustenance and such?
Okay, the study looked at about 1,000 different species because it was looking at biodiversity patterns. And one of the things that actually was a little bit surprising is we then divided it up into species that are either have more reef fish species or open water species. And surprisingly, we kind of found similar patterns across a lot of different species. So it does seem like that's going to be a problem both for, you know, small scale fisheries that people rely on for subsistence, as well as kind of larger scale fisheries are focusing on commercially important species like tuna.
Already we're starting to see in countries like Kiribati, Tuvalu, and that fishermen reporting reduced catches or having to go out further into the sea to actually find fish and stuff. Is this all part of that? Is it already underway?
So one of the things that's really difficult to sometimes tell is how much is due to fishing pressure versus changes in climate. And for the most part, it is something where, you know, oftentimes trends that we see are a bit of both. And certainly that would be consistent with kind of projections that people might see under climate change. But, you know, it may be kind of a combination of historical overfishing as well.
Is this trend reversible? You say kind of the 50-80% is in the sort of worst case scenario of global warming, but say with the targets, I mean, we've got all the world leaders in Germany at the moment trying to thrash out some rules for climate action and stuff. If action comes together, is this avoidable or reversible or anything?
I think that avoidable is definitely a possibility. I think the hard thing is just once we have CO2 in the atmosphere, a lot of it will stick around for centuries. So once it happens, it's going to take a long time to reverse. But I think we're still at a point in time where we can avoid the worst impact scenarios. So I think that this is a really important moment in history for that reason. And we did find that for a lot of the climate variables, if you kind of take this best case scenario where we do take action now, the changes in things like temperature, pH would be 2 to 4 times smaller than otherwise. So that's certainly going to have a positive impact compared to a business as usual scenario.
A Hawaiian marine scientist says evidence shows there is no doubt Hawaii's waters are being overfished, but he's hopeful traditional Hawaiian sustainability practices may help. Dr. Alan Friedlander says 25,000 marine surveys conducted over the last decade indicate significant depletion of fish stocks around the main Hawaiian islands. He says recent recognition of the problem by the state legislature is a huge leap forward, and there was a fundamental shift with the public now realizing that more has to be done to sustain the marine environment. Jenny Meyer asked him what action is planned as a result of the research.
So what we'd like to see out of it is kind of a multi-pronged approach now, basically predicated on education for the most part, is trying to use traditional Hawaiian values about proper codes of conduct, proper fishing practices that were used in the past to manage the resources, encourage community-based management areas, which there's been a renaissance of in Hawaii as of late, where Native Hawaiian communities, for the most part, have trying to reestablish control over their local areas. More enforcement, which is a huge problem. Every fisherman complains about the lack of enforcement. And then finally, a network of marine protected areas, which we feel will be the most effective way to help manage resources into the future. This will not only conserve biodiversity within the protected areas, but also enhance fisheries by having more and larger fish inside the protected areas and spilling over and helping to populate overfished areas.
And how much fight back do you expect from commercial fishermen? Because I guess that seems to be this kind of perennial tension between people who say we need to eat and others who say, well, if you're too greedy, you're going to go without for your grandchildren.
Right. That's exactly it. So there's constituents on all sides. In the nearshore waters, surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, the large proportion of the catch is non-commercial. So the recreational subsistence, non-reported commercial catch accounts for nearly 10 times greater catch than the commercial catch. So it's really everybody involved. So you do get a lot of pushback from people saying, you know, you're preventing me from helping to feed my family and so forth. But we're trying to get people to take the long view on this, that, yeah, well, this may help you in this particular point in time, but the next generation of people is going to be far worse off if we don't do something about it now. We're kind of a tipping point in Hawaii, where it's really populated areas around Oahu, where Honolulu is, and around the island of Maui have shown severe degradation. But we see places elsewhere around the state where there's not a lot of people that are still very healthy. So they are probably currently helping to sustain the populations. But between climate change and all the local stressors, things are on a downhill slide. And we hope that people are going to take a longer view. And so our recent study and talking to people and getting out and trying to engage people and trying to reestablish the knowledge that existed in Hawaii before European contact are critical elements of getting people to take the long view about sustainability of the ecosystem.
Bougainville Copper Limited, which has just held its second board meeting in Bougainville in 27 years, says it remains on course to resume its mining operations in Panguna. The company, which is now part-owned by the autonomous Bougainville government, was forced out of Bougainville in 1990 by a civil war. Don Wiseman asked the BLC company secretary, Mark Hitchcock, what progress is being made in terms of getting back. But he began by seeking clarification over the former Rio Tinto shares that the Papua New Guinea government Prime Minister Peter O'Neill has promised to Bougainvillean landowners. Mr. Hitchcock says the shares are not yet to be transferred and efforts are being made to clarify what's going on.
I know that directors from Bougainville Copper have had some dialogue, and we have equally had dialogue with President Momus about the two leaders having joint conversations.
Are you confident it's going to get sorted out?
It's not an easy thing to be resolved, and really that's a matter for Prime Minister O'Neill to follow through.
BCL at the beginning of the year produced a timeline for what it planned to do if it got a chance to go ahead at Panguna, and that culminated, I think, by about 2026 with the mine being in full operation. But a critical part was that there were going to be things in place from the end of 2017. So how's that going?
Yeah, we've made really good progress on moving forward there. We've opened our office in Booker. We've recruited a team on the ground in Bougainville. We have project offices that are actually up in Panguna and Arawa. So you know, we've got an open dialogue going on with all the stakeholders in the area. So that's going well. The one thing that does hold us up a little bit is the ongoing dispute with the Landowner Association. And we're respectfully just waiting for mediation to occur there before we're sort of invited back in there.
Yes, I mean, this is not a minor issue, is it? This group, the group that Philip Miriori is leading, is, as he believes anyway, the critical group, because it's the group that's right at the site of the mine. And you've got to get on side with them, don't you? So is that going to happen? Are you going to be able to do that?
Well, we believe we do. Look, I can't say too much about the mediation, but we have seen widespread approval for the return to mining and with Bougainville Copper with the people that have been attending mediation. And you know, we're confident that we have a widespread support of the landowners in the region, in the Panguna area.
Let's presume that somehow you can overcome those difficulties with the OC Kayang group. Then what happens?
The exploration license renewal process is now being followed through, and there is a warden's hearing in early December, and Bougainville Copper will be presenting at the warden's hearing our full plans of how we'll move forward with the new Panguna project.
So the exploration license, you've got to go through that stage before you can actually, for instance, start to consider exploring.
Correct. Yes, we need tenure over the area before we can go forward, and the social acceptance of the stakeholders.
So I guess there is the possibility you're not ever going to get that social acceptance. So then what happens to BCL?
Well, we have the support of the Bougainville government. You know, we've seen some widespread support, but we have people on the ground, so we know that there is support for Bougainville Copper. There will always be detractors in a crowd, and we need the chance to be invited back there to get in and present our case and our credentials and enlighten what a modern mine could or would look like.
That's a critical thing, isn't it, of course? Because, I mean, one of the big issues in 1989 and 1990 was the environmental pollution resulting from the mine. You've got to be able to show people how you would do things a lot differently now. Are you in a position to do that?
I believe we are. Like, the world of mining has changed since 1989, and like, modern practices dictate that things are done differently. For instance, how would tailings be treated? And that's all part of our modern design and plans, how we will deal with those sorts of things.
One of the criticisms that's come from groups like the OC Kayang group is that BCL has still got a lot of people involved in it who were there in the Rio Tinto days.
It's a fairly reputable board that we have, and like with the recent appointment of Mal Tokolo and also Peter Graham, you know, renowned businessman who was involved with the LNG project in Papua New Guinea, with prominent ex-prime ministers and ministers. It's an independent board, and it is run for and by the shareholders.
Yes, the company itself, though, what in terms of staff?
Staff, we've got a small team, and there are very few now that were Rio Tinto.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Perron, wishing you well. Just to remind you, of course, there is a daily 15-minute edition of the program that does go to the Pacific. But for this one, for the 30-minute weekly one, we'll see you in 7 days' time. So, until next time, so long, take care, bye for now.